Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Beth Cloran, the Department of Health and Human Services Chief Information Officer. Beth, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I appreciate your time. It's been quite a while since I've had the HHS CIO on the program. Your predecessor, Frank Bateman, had come on before. So there's some older priorities I'd like to catch up with. So let's start down that path. The first one was this idea of an open office and the technology to support the open office. I think at the time, HHS was either moving or upgrading their office space. So just give me a sense in terms of the status of that concept of the open office and how, from a CIO's perspective, you guys are supporting that through different technologies.
Within the department, obviously, it's a very federated organization, but across the department, we are very supportive of telework and alternate work methodologies, and each of the organizations are moving forward and putting technologies in place to support that concept. At the department level, for the Office of the Secretary and the organizations that we support, we've done a number of things similar to the operating divisions, one of those being our move to Office 365 in the cloud. So we actually have, both for the Office of the Secretary and for the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, have already moved to email as a service in the cloud. That has actually helped to provide better capabilities, and we've actually upgraded our virtual private network so that we can increase our capacity from a telework or remote location perspective. A lot of our offices have gone to smaller seating arrangements to be more collaborative within the office as well as collaboration outside of the office, and we expect that to continue. To support that, we have actually moving to voice over IP, which allows you to take your phone with you. So whether you're at a desk or you just have your computer, you can actually have the same phone number wherever you are and have your voice messages come on your iPhone, on a desktop phone, whether it's soft, and even onto your laptop. So that allows people to have one number and be able to use it wherever they are. And we actually are also trying to make sure that we're improving our security by putting some additional capabilities in place in this mobile capability technology realm to support those systems, but also to make sure they're secure in those worlds. So there's a different variety of different security capabilities that we've put in place that follow industry standards. And the last thing that we're also trying to do is, the next thing we'll do is move our office capabilities to the cloud to also try to make that more virtual. And we're trying to provide some knowledge base so that people can provide some self-help when we move forward to another contract. In addition to that, obviously, we're trying to make our new contracts, whether they're for mobile devices or for office, trying to make sure that those are flexible and not just providing the technology of old, but making sure that those new contracts are providing the capabilities that we'll need 5 years from now.
So a couple things to unpack from that. Let me back up for a sec. One of the things when you talk about moving Office 365 in the cloud is email. I know for years people have been able to probably get their email on their BlackBerries or now their iPhones or Android devices. This is separate and above that. This is putting, obviously, email in the cloud, but the benefits there is not just, hey, I can get it anywhere at any time, but it's also the storage and the capabilities that come with it.
Right. So we started with the email as a cloud. The next thing we're trying to do is the OneDrive capability so you can have your documents anywhere. And then obviously, coupling that with the Office 365 in the cloud will make it virtual any place. So not only will you have unlimited storage, but be able to utilize those capabilities on multiple types of devices and to be able to share information more collaboratively than in the past.
And some of those Office capabilities in the cloud means that the OneDrive, as you said, is once I store my documents in that cloud storage, I can get it from anywhere I want, but also I'll have the Excel spreadsheet or the Microsoft Word or whatever other kind of tools I need right there in the cloud. That's part of that Office 365 suite, correct?
Correct, yes. I mean, that's the goal, is to not only to save money, but to add some other additional capabilities and to be able to utilize them at any time, any place, from any type of platform.
And at the same time, then, are you also giving people laptops and other types of, whether tablet devices? Because as you said, it's more collaborative workspace, so they can go wherever they want. I can't imagine them, they're dragging their desktop around with them, right?
No, so we, at least at the department level, we've really stopped, except for in very rare cases, ever giving desktops. So the predominance is laptops at this point. As I said, there's only a couple of use cases where we still give desktops. We are also moving to better utilization of convertible desktops, which is a tablet and a laptop combined. A lot of people are now using tablets, and of course, we are ending our use of BlackBerries and going exclusively with smartphones as well to be able to use that platform on any of those devices.
It's interesting. I think you're the first CIO who I've talked with who mentioned the convertible tablet laptop. Was that just a no-brainer, or was that something that the staff had said to you, hey, we really want this, how do we make it work? And those types of devices have advanced far enough that you feel safe and they have enough power, compute, storage, et cetera, that they're usable.
So we actually have had some use cases where the tablets were not sufficient. So they wanted the flexibility of a tablet when it did work for them, but being able to use the laptop capability on a kind of a more daily basis in that type of environment. And then a lot of the new devices actually have PIV built in, which most tablets do not. So that also was a significant benefit for that capability. And we actually had one of our organizations that had gone all tablet and had significant issues with them because of the way that they conducted business. And they actually switched to this type of device in order to meet their mission needs. And so that's why we are trying to move more from the laptop-based to this laptop to a convertible for that group of individuals. And then knowing some of our executives and another set of individuals are going to want tablet only.
When you talk about Office 365, when you talk about email in the cloud, what does that mean for applications as well? Because there's an application piece. As you move more to the cloud, there's an application modernization piece. I know we may be getting into some of the newer priorities, but I think it's all related.
Obviously, HHS overall has been fairly slow to adopt cloud overall. In OMB, when we were doing our portfolio stats in 15 and at the beginning of 16, we were second to last in cloud adoption. We were actually at 1%. But as we have been moving some of our email as a service and a couple other capabilities that have improved, and in some cases, some organizations' funding has driven that, over the last year, we have increased our cloud from that 1% to over 18%. And if we continue on the track that we have for this year, we should achieve and actually surpass the OMB goal of 20% in the cloud. We've had a couple of challenges internally with migrating to the cloud, some of that being an understanding. So in 2015, we actually stood up a cloud sandbox. And the purpose of that was to allow folks to come and play and understand how the cloud works, try some of their applications in a safe kind of environment to test it out. And that proved so successful that that helped to accelerate some of the adoption for cloud. We actually have moved some of those applications to the cloud. The other thing that helped is a lot of our organizations indicated they didn't have a contractual mechanism to get to the cloud. So over the last 12 to 18 months, we actually put in contracts that they can utilize for Salesforce. We have our Microsoft agreement so they can get to Azure. A lot of the folks there's a contract for Amazon services as well. And then we actually have some other folks that are using smaller cloud providers as well. And that actually has helped to speed some of that up. Actually, our best adoption right now has been in the smaller organizations where they saw significant cost reduction, both from an administrative and from a hosting perspective by moving to the cloud. So they have adopted more diligently. I think the other thing that has helped to speed up some of the cloud adoption is in December of 2015, we actually moved our main financial system to the cloud. And with the success of that migration, that helped to show folks that it is okay because they're very concerned about their data. Well, if we can move our financial data to the cloud, maybe it's okay for me to move my data to the cloud as well. So I think that also helped to speed some of that up. And right now, if based on our projections, we think that we'll have almost 41% of our investments in some way, shape, or form moving to the cloud beginning during this fiscal year.
And I know I've talked to several of your bureau-level CIOs, whether it's FDA or NIH, and some of they're seeing some of the small bureaus within NIH also are seeing some benefits from the cloud, especially around the big data challenge that I think everybody is facing. The other piece of this is, I guess, from the workforce, is as you move to this collaborative desktop, this collaborative piece, are you looking at hoteling or are you looking at some kind of system to so people can say, I'm going to reserve this desk on this date for this time? Or is that something that is not quite needed yet?
So for us, that isn't quite needed yet because the amount of people that are doing hoteling is not at all near the level of a GSA, for example. We have had some scheduling system for conference rooms, but we haven't had to go to a scheduling system yet for desks.
I think that's the key when you've reached that telework peak is when people come in and be like, I'm giving up my desk and where do I sit today? And then you have to start kind of figuring that out. Again, as you mentioned, GSA is probably ahead of most other agencies. Beth, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can talk a couple other older priorities. My guest is Beth Kaloran, the Department of Health and Human Services Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Beth Kaloran, the Department of Health and Human Services Chief Information Officer. Now, Beth, we spent the first part of the show talking a lot about cloud, and cloud is such a big area for so many CIOs. But, the other area that last time I spoke to the HHS CIO that was also a big deal is around workforce, and specifically cybersecurity workforce as one example. So talk a little bit about how you guys are bringing in the right workers and specifically around cybersecurity.
Obviously, cybersecurity is a priority not just in our agency but across the federal government. Obviously, right now we have a hiring freeze, but with that, we are still working on our plan, and when the freeze lifts, obviously be moving full force to keep continuing to recruit in the cyber arena. But within the cyber workforce, we actually have an HHS IT strategic plan all on its own for cyber hiring, and that has been done and developed collaboratively with our HR counterparts within the department as well as across the operating divisions. We actually have a cybersecurity workforce task force within the organization about how to improve our cyber hiring and to recruit the best that we can. We think that we have a really phenomenal mission, and by even being able to promote that mission, we really think that we can bring in the best talent. It's just making sure that we understand and line up our basically how we're going to bring them in and some of those organizations we want to partner with on an ongoing basis so that we have individuals lined up. So one of the things that we have tried to do is streamline how to bring forth people in. One of the things we've been working on, obviously, is direct hire within our organization. Each of the operating divisions had kind of defined how to do that separately. So we partnered with the HR organization at the department level to provide some guidance out to each of our operating divisions around direct hire, which has really been beneficial. Another thing that we've been doing is having ongoing postings so that under the direct hire capability, we always have vacancies that are being advertised and people can apply on an ongoing basis. Then we can qualify them for the direct hire and bring the talent on as quickly as we find it. We've been trying to partner with universities for hiring fairs. I know federal level, OPM and DHS and even OMB have actually done some federal level hiring fairs that we've participated in. We've actually been working directly with OPM how to establish talent and performance management to help us retain the talent once we have it in and making sure they have new opportunities and challenges. Because what we find, especially in the cyber arena, is people want to stay challenged. So if they're doing the same thing over and over again, we tend to lose them back out to the private sector. So how can we either move them around our very large organization? So one day they might be working on a hack, some big incident. The next day they might be going to work to precision medicine, and the next day they might be helping to protect medical devices at FDA. How can we do that more efficiently, effectively? Or making sure that they're keeping their talents up. We're also trying to make sure that we give them a wide variety of expertise. So if they want to be in cyber, but they might also want to learn about architecture or threat intelligence, how to make sure that they're getting those skills and capabilities. We're also trying to make sure that we're doing education and outreach as much as we can directly with certain kinds of universities. For example, we're definitely trying to hit minority universities, especially around Black and Hispanic individuals, because we want to bolster their numbers within our workforce. Right now, they tend to be our most underutilized segments, and we want to improve those. So we're having some partnerships, for example, with Howard University to help with that. We're also trying to be a little creative in some other areas. So, for example, DOD has been doing hackathons. How can we try to do that to find talent that may not be through the traditional educational pipelines, and being able to find other cyber professionals through secondary means as well?
All right, so a lot going on around that. Let me back up to the beginning when you talk about the plans and OPM and OMB required each agency to do a cyber workforce assessment. That's what I think you were talking about initially when you talk about looking at those skill sets, correct?
We actually had done this even before that. So we actually had been, even before that requirement came, we actually had together looked at how we could develop a workforce plan. Secondarily, we have done an assessment after that that shows, you know, where our workforce is and potential certifications they have and gaps. And so that will help us to update and inform that plan in additional ways. But we actually had the cyber workforce plan even before the congressional requirement came down.
That's always nice when you're ahead of the game a little bit, right?
Yeah.
That's nice. You don't have to have another fire drill, so to speak. One of the things you mentioned is the Cyber Workforce Task Force, and that's looking at ways to recruit and train and bring people in. Is that task force made up of both CIO office and HR office and other people? Or talk a little bit about that task force concept and how do they work and what do they do?
The predominance of them right now are people within the CIO organizations, both CIOs and cyber professionals, in addition to HR professionals. And the reason that they're put together is obviously some of them have a network around potential ways to get individuals in. Organizations know, the HR organization obviously knows capabilities that we can utilize and regulations we need to follow. The cyber community knows what kind of talents that they're looking for and skills that they need within those organizations and challenges that they've had. And so obviously you have one side that has the requirements and individuals that they're looking for, and partnering with the HR community on the mechanisms and ways that they can bring them in. And then in some cases, obviously, there are potentially some changes that may even have to be done at the OPM or MB level, which is why that group is also interfacing with those two organizations as well.
And you mentioned direct hire authority. I think agencies sometimes forget that they have that specifically for cybersecurity. Are you guys finding a lot of luck using these methodologies, not just direct hire, but keeping job descriptions open? And so when people do apply and they are qualified and they meet your needs, you can bring them in more quickly.
So once we actually were able to work through, so that was one of the first kind of wins within this task force, was to do that. So we actually were able to start that process in the fall. And through that, where we had, you know, hired, we were basically maintaining our attrition. So we'd bring two on, we'd lose two, we'd bring two on, we'd lose two. At the time of the hiring freeze, we actually had, just in my office, 20 cyber professionals in queue to bring on. So it was actually showing some payoff, and we expect that once the hiring freeze clears that we will continue to see that payoff continue.
I know the hiring freeze, as we've talked with many agencies, is definitely, there's a lot of pain being felt right now. One of the other things I want to bring up around the hiring of cybersecurity workers is you also have, as you mentioned, the training piece. And I think that's it's a great example you gave of, you don't want people to get bored and you don't want them to just say, I'm always doing hacks or I'm always doing something else. They get to do a variety of things. Is that, do you have enough people? Because I imagine you have more than enough opportunities for them.
Yeah, I mean, so that's one of the things that right now, so this actually also aligns to our new strategic plan, which I think we're going to talk about soon, is trying to do that. So one of the actual goals in our strategic plan is to identify and define capabilities for recruiting and maintaining and how to share lessons learned and staff across the board. So we actually have a group that is kind of being jointly led by both CMS and HRSA, and I think one of our new CEOs is going to help with that. And there are representatives there from each of the organizations in addition of how to do that. Would it be details? Would it be rotations? Would we do job sharing? What would that be to be able to get folks into some of those roles? And so that's a work in progress, but we expect that that's going to really help with our retention to make sure that people are being able to have a variety of different kinds of capabilities and skills that they learn. It's one of the things at some of our interviews, sometimes when people exit, and also just when they talk to their employees that they're looking for.
I think that's a great idea, and I'll be interested to learn more as you guys kind of get this interagency or intra-agency work set up where you can talk about, you know, rotations or details or whatever, because I think other agencies would definitely benefit from that. One of the things you mentioned was strategic plan, and you're right, we're going to talk about that next. So give me a heads up. This has been developed. I know we talked about it, I guess, late last fall, early winter. Give me an update of where it's at and how you guys are using it to plan your way forward.
This is one of the things when I first took over as the acting CIO that was kind of near and dear to my heart to put forward an IT strategic plan that wasn't done at the departmental level but was developed with input from all of the other CIOs across the operating divisions and something that they endorsed. So it began last February, and there were obviously a number of sessions from that time to the summer to draft the document, and it actually was signed in September. And so right now that actually is kind of the guiding principle in this department. It wasn't just signed by myself, but it was signed by every operating division. And we actually had a secondary planning session around the document in October where we took the strategic plan and established priorities and initiatives for each of the five goals and areas that we wanted to work for the next 12 to 15 months. And so myself and each of the operating divisions work on that on an ongoing basis, make sure that we are using that to basically support everything that we do and to make sure that our work is in alignment.
Beth, I want to go into that strategic plan and some of those goals, but first let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can jump right in. My guest is Beth Killoran, Department of Health and Human Services Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Beth Killoran, the Department of Health and Human Services Chief Information Officer. Now, Beth, right before break, you were talking about your new strategic plan, and I just want to clarify one thing. You talked about working with the operating administrations. Those are the CIOs you've been working with, and those are the CIOs who signed off on this IT strategic plan, just to clarify that, correct?
That is correct.
All right, because you never know if there's deputy administrators or administrators that sign off, but the buy-in from the CIOs obviously is the probably the most key to something like this. And then you mentioned a recent planning meeting where you looked at the five goals and the initiatives under them. Walk me through some of those five goals and some of those initiatives.
And just to tell you, so while the CIOs did sign off on it, we actually did vet it even at the highest levels. We actually sent it all the way up to our deputy secretary and even out. So we wanted to make sure we had a wide variety of people looking at it. So our five areas that are within the strategic plan are probably not novel. I think every CIO probably has these as some of their goals. So obviously our number one, which is what we just talked about, is our IT workforce. The second goal, not surprising, is cybersecurity and privacy. The third is around shared services. The third is interoperability and usability. The fifth one is IT management. So each of those, so what we did in the fall is we actually had a CIO summit, which we spent 2 days offsite to. Each one of these has a number of objectives under that. So from those objectives, we know there's only so much time and resources that we can apply to them, and we wanted to understand from the folks what did they think was the most important for us to work on. So, for example, if we look back on what we just talked about, which was the IT workforce piece, there were two things that became really important for us to work on, both of them being under, first was to identify a capability, and the capability so we can forecast what we're trying to look and have an effective hiring capability. And the other part was around making sure that we streamline the employment process so that we can hire and bring people on more quickly. And then obviously when they are brought on, how to develop and retain them throughout their workforce so that we aren't continually losing the great talent that we've brought in, trained, and become vital to our organization. Within the cybersecurity and privacy arena, the biggest objective that we're working on is improving cybersecurity and privacy posture of our IT systems. But we also want to make sure that our next objective that we're really working on is to prioritize our cybersecurity investments through a risk-based approach. So everything we're trying to do, we're trying to align to the enterprise risk model, not just for cybersecurity, but for all the things that we're doing. So how do we take a risk-based approach to make sure that as we apply our resources, that we're buying down our risk the most effectively that we can as quickly as possible? So while there might be something that, you know, is going to cost $5 million, is only going to decrease our risk by 1%, while we could do $1 million and it's going to decrease our risk by 10%. We'd rather do the $1 million and decrease our risk. So we need to understand our threat posture. And within shared services, the area that we're most working on right now is a common understanding of our shared services and making sure that we have an enterprise framework, because right now what's kind of been happening with shared services for us is it's catch as catch can. Somebody might hear about something somebody has and they kind of get together and share it, but we don't have any kind of construct targets for shared services within our enterprise architecture, and we really don't have any sort of catalog of what kind of capabilities are out there that potentially either some operating visions would want to share or what might be a benefit for sharing, or even what's out there that organizations might want to utilize. And so we wanted to start with that. And then with interoperability, we want to make sure that we improve the use of data, so, you know, recording data once and utilize it multiple times. So we decided what we need to understand here or start with is promoting the interoperable exchange of our data, but also what would be the governance model with that. So we're going to work on both of those. And then for IT management, obviously Fatara is a big piece here, but we want to make sure that we're maturing and updating our IT management processes and governance so that they follow the new Fatara capabilities, and making sure that we have the ability to reflect those requirements and everybody understands and implements them across the department. So there's a couple other streamlining capabilities that we're going to do there as well, but that's the predominant one that we're working on for this year.
All right, so a lot to unpack. Let me start at the end, and let me begin with Fatara. Give me a sense of the impact Fatara's had on HHS so far.
Everybody always says within the department we have a very federated organization and that it has its challenges. I actually think that that has its opportunities. I do feel that, you know, we have a strong CIO council. Each of the organizations is really supportive of each other. I think I have a good relationship with each of the component or operating division CIOs. Each of them is willing to help. We actually had at the department level a couple of challenges over the last year, and each one of them said anything that they could do to help. As we've been moving Fatara and moving forward with Fatara, each of them has been very supportive of having sessions around understanding their portfolios and going through budget reviews and acquisition processes. I have been very fortunate to be able to delegate to the majority of the CIOs responsibility based on those relationships and the maturity that they have. And I think that being able to have an open dialogue, because in many cases the operating divisions or components within an organization have a significant capabilities They have the mission, and so they have put forward and done a lot of implementations for IT, and they actually solved a lot of problems. And so if you just listen to that and understand how they can bring forward what their lessons learned, it becomes a very beneficial capability. I think that's one of the best things with FATARA, is that increased dialogue and understanding lessons learned and being able to build off of successes and failures.
One of the things that FATARA asked for is both budget and acquisition oversight. You mentioned the delegation of a lot of that. How has it changed from your perspective in terms of where your role is on the budget side versus where, you know, the CIO's role was maybe traditionally for HHS?
My predecessor really had very little to do with the budget formulation process. Each of the operating divisions kind of built their budget separately. You know, they moved forward separately, and they obviously have different committees. I think that where that has changed and strengthened here at the department is it's in two ways, and I'll say it's both vertically and horizontally. So we have an Assistant Secretary for Financial Resources, or ASFR. That's where our Chief Financial Officer sits. Our organization has a very strong relationship with them, and I think it strengthened significantly with FATARA. So for the budget guidance, we actually work with them, and they actually now do an IT addendum to their budget guidance, and we're actually working with them. We did that for the last 2 years, and we'll do that again this year. So when the budget guidance goes out, it's not I'm sending something and the CFO sending, it's just the CFO sending. And then as the budgets get submitted, there actually is this budget addendum that the IT piece comes under, but it goes over to the CFO organization as the regular budget does. At the Optiv level, each of the CIOs has to be part of that decision-making process. And then once that comes forward, the CFO and I have a joint meeting with each operating division with their IT budget, and we go through that. And they talk about what their business priorities are, and based on the guidance we sent out, we also talk about the departmental objectives and how they're working to accomplish those, and if there are gaps in them, how they're going to fill those gaps within that budget cycle or within the next couple of budget cycles. And we go forward and either approve the budget for submission at those meetings, or we ask for some changes to their budget before they proceed. I think that has helped to increase the transparency. And then for major initiatives, very large ones, even before they get to that process, they actually have to come to our governance structure and present their business case for those new initiatives before they even put them into the budget process. And we have our CFO organization represented there as well. And so we can actually see the business cases even before they make it into a budget submission.
And I think part of what FATARA was trying to do is make sure that you as the CIO was at the table. I know it's one of those old phrases I think most of us look at and shake our heads at, but as long as you're part of that conversation, so you know if the FDA, if CMS, if NIH wants to do a big new shiny technology program, and you go, oh, now I know about this. We have that over here that we can just, we have the 80% already done, so we can just do the 20% versus they start over and they're already down the path and you go, hey, you know, we had this other thing over here that you could have used. Is that something that you're seeing, or at least you're hopeful to have seen, that you're able to step in at the right moment and say, hey, don't forget, you know, here's the trade of information?
Yeah, I mean, so we've actually had some of that dialogue as some of the new initiatives have come forward. Obviously, there's definitely some differences in certain capabilities. You know, CMS obviously has had the most of those come forward based on some statutory changes and things that they need to do. But even in those kind of conversations, we talk about, you know, well, if you're building I'll just give you an example, an identity management capability, you know, how potentially could other operating divisions leverage that, or how could they at least understand that technology if they potentially wanted to use it? So we're not just building something once, we're building something that potentially can be utilized or at least adopted in other organizations.
And I know I want to talk about shared services and interoperability, but first let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can jump into those IT strategic plan priorities. My guest is Beth Killoran, the Chief Information Officer at the Department of Health and Human Services. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Beth Kaloran, the Department of Health and Human Services Chief Information Officer. Now, Beth, before break, we're talking about your strategic plan and some of the priorities that came under that. And that leads me down the path to shared services, and you said that's another big priority. Talk a little bit about where shared services fits in now. I know HHS, for instance, provides shared services for the rest of the government for instance, financial management. So where are you guys kind of fitting in terms of using internal shared services?
So we're trying to figure out the best way for us to move into this arena. As I said, I mean, what's kind of been happening through osmosis, if nothing else, is somebody will hear that one organization has some kind of capability. They don't want to recreate that capability because it'd be very costly to them, especially for smaller ones, smaller organizations. And so they kind of do one-off agreements with that bigger organization to utilize a capability, but there's not a formalized plan, and there really isn't a way to do that. So the first thing we wanted to try to do is this year is really establish a policy that operationalizes how enterprise services would be done and a framework for across the department so that we can understand who is providing service, who would be willing to provide services, and how would organizations utilize those services. The second thing we're trying to do around shared services is basically communicate what those would be. So who is building what kind of capabilities and they would want to deliver as a shared service? How could they potentially talk to internal customers about what their needs would be? And would they be able to build that service not only for themselves, but by not delaying it or making it cost prohibitive, be able to provide that service with some either similar requirements or the exact same requirements to other customers? So that's one of the things we're trying to do. And then obviously we're also trying to standardize some of our data centers and also making sure that we have some more standardized cloud service requirements so that we, because everybody that's kind of doing it on their own right now, which is causing some potential disconnects. And obviously we have some security issues that we want to make sure of. And so we want to make sure that we standardize that this year. And then the last thing through the Megabyte Act that we think will also help is trying to make sure that we have a department level IT asset management of our software licenses so that from an enterprise perspective, we might be able to do some buys and use a very large organization to drive some of the costs down. Or if there are contracts out there that are already used, how do you make one organization kind of build that kind of contract and others to utilize, again, from the bigs to smalls? So a small organization might spend, you know, $1,500 on a license, and a bigger organization might be getting that same license for $500. How can they utilize those other contracts to drive some of the costs down in their license agreement?
Everyone loves the concept of shared services, but when it comes down to it, do people really want to share, right? I mean, that seems to be a lot of times the question. Are you finding that when you meet with the other CIOs, because of budget pressures and other resource pressures, they are more inclined to say, yes, get this catalog set up. Yes, let's look at enterprise licenses and see what I can benefit from.
I think it depends on the organization, and that's why we're trying to do this as a coalition of the willing. I think in any large organization, establishing mandates has mixed results, and that's why we're trying to establish a framework so that those that do want to provide the services can have a mechanism to do that, and those that want to utilize the services understand where those services might be and how they could utilize them within the department so that they don't have to go out on their own and obviously potentially reduce their time to market or their time for implementing those capabilities.
And I think the coalition of the willing is an interesting approach because the people will see benefits and then those who are maybe a little reluctant or say, well, we're too big or we can do this on our own better, will see, oh, well they're saving X amount of percentage of dollars, or they're getting better service for cheaper prices, and then that brings people in as well. I imagine that's part of what your hope is get a few early adopters, and then others will come.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's kind of what we're already seeing. So I think the earlier adopters for wanting to utilize services are the smaller organizations that do tend to have some more challenges around budgets. I think that if the budgets go down, that you might see some more of that. But then as that has happened and they are seeing some capabilities, then a larger organization are like, well, how did you get that? And so we have seen some adoption of large organizations with other large organizations based on successes that smaller or other organizations have seen through a certain capability. So, yes, it kind of, once you see success, then others were like, I want to get onto that capability as well.
I want to shift gears to cybersecurity. You said that was another major strategic priority, but also there's a lot of initiatives under that. And you talked a lot about risk. And at the same time, we can also talk about Einstein and the Continuous Diagnostics and Mitigation Program, which is all part of this understanding your risk concept and risk posture. Talk, if you can, a little bit about how you're going about understanding the risk posture of HHS's systems and data.
Within the department, we actually have CFO organization asked for last year established something called the Enterprise Risk Management Framework, which isn't new. It's kind of a goal across the federal government. And within the organization, they actually brought business leaders from across the organization to work to identify what they thought their most significant risks were within the department. And it's not surprising that cybersecurity is in the bullseye of risks within that department. So what we did is from that saying, okay, if this is one of our top risks, as an agency for being able to accomplish our mission, what does that mean? So we actually looked at the NIST framework for the different phases for accomplishing cybersecurity, your prevent, detect, respond, recover. And what we looked at is then how are we applying our financial and personnel resources to that construct? And why would that be making it more risky? And how then would we mitigate the risk? So what we found is in probably, this is fairly common, is 80% of our money and people were going to respond and recover. 20% were going to prevent and detect. And as such, we're always in a kind of a chaos mode of once something happens, doing something about it. And so what we have been looking at is, and CDM is going to be a big part of this, how do we shift to that prevent and detect mode? And how do we take information that we're gathering to understand how our threat posture is changing so that we can have a goal over the next 3, 6, 12 months, because it changes that quickly on the prevent side.
Beth, there's so much more to talk about. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I think we could do a whole nother show. You'll be joining us for an online chat as well, so we look forward to having you join us for that. So for now, we'll say goodbye and remind our listeners that they can ask you questions. They can visit federalnewsradio.com and sign up for the online chat. My guest has been Beth Kaloran, the Department of Health and Human Services Chief Information Officer. Beth, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.